What is algae? Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to another edition of Future Tense. Here's that question again. What is algae?
Our unseasonably warm weather is also feeding the biggest algae bloom on the West Coast in decades.
Bondi dyed red.
4 kilometres of Sydney's coastline transformed by an algal bloom.
This is a visible satellite of Lake Erie. Notice all this green right here, that is the newly emerged algae bloom. Remember last year when Toledo couldn't drink the water for a couple of weeks because of the algae bloom? This is a toxic algae bloom beginning around the Lake Erie.
You could be forgiven for thinking that algae is the environmental equivalent of the Antichrist. And certainly toxic blooms are a big problem. But on today's show, we'll meet a range of people who invite us to go beyond the bad news and look instead at the incredible potential of algae for everything from plastics to fuel to environmental cleanup. Reimagining algae, that's our topic today.
The reason I'm excited about algae is because of the potential it has in so many areas. I guess I have an environmental conscience and an awareness, and my PhD is in anaerobic digestion of wastewater. So I have an awareness of the wastewater industry and what's required. And the wastewater industry tends to throw large amounts of concrete, pipework and machinery and electrons at the wastewater problem.
But Simon Tannock's approach, in contrast, is to clean up our waterways by essentially fighting fire with fire, encouraging the growth of a good form of algae called diatoms to counter the bad algae, the cyanobacteria or blue-green algae that we know cause toxicity. Dr. Tannock is an environmental engineer who runs a company called New Algae Enviro, and he's developed a special product using nanotechnology. His process essentially coats the micronutrients needed for algae to grow in a casing of silica. And then, packaged in that way, the bad algae don't recognise the nutrients, but the good algae, the diatoms, do. Simon Tannock.
It depends on the health and the condition of the water, but we added it to one water body and the manager rang up the next day and said, it's changed colour, is that okay? And I said, well, what's it changed from? And he said, well, that nasty green colour, that means the cyanobacteria are doing well. And it went brown. And I said, that's perfect because diatoms are generally brown. So it means that the diatoms jumped up and got going straight away. Sometimes it takes 3 weeks or a month. And again, that depends on the quality of the water and what's happening in there. But generally, we would expect within a week for the diatoms to get going, because they are, in any natural event, like a rain event where nutrients flush in, the diatoms are they're kind of the first responders. They say, there's nutrients, let's grow. And they grow like crazy until they've used up all the nutrients they can. Then other algae types will move in and take over.
And the traditional way to deal with algal blooms, toxic algal blooms, is to use algicides or some sort of chemical, isn't it? So this is a much more environmentally friendly alternative.
It is. Certainly the algicides and various poisons have been used. They're starting to be backed away from. There are other methods, such as better circulation within the water body itself. That tends to work if it's quite a deep one. If it's not a deep, so maybe a shallow lake or a shallow lagoon, then that won't work so well. Then that's where the problems can really start to take hold. So our product actually balances that out for the long term on a long-term management scheme. But it's, you might use 1 litre in a hectare once a month, depending on the nitrogen level. So it's a tiny amount, but it's so powerful because we are utilising nanotechnology to deliver the micronutrients exactly to who we want, so we don't have to take a broad stroke approach.
And dealing with algal blooms is already a problem in a country like Australia, but it's tipped to be an even bigger problem, isn't it, with climate change?
Absolutely. Cyanobacteria or blue-green algae tend to be a problem in summer, and obviously because the temperatures go up. So we are seeing the blooms reported more and more right now, sort of through late January, then into February, March, etc. moving forward, they are, and looking at the past data, we can see that they are arriving earlier and they are lasting longer, and that is based on temperature. So as we do continue to push the temperature up, that will be a problem. It's exacerbated by the fact that blue-green algae are actually able to push the condition of the water towards their own favour. Every time they bloom, when they die off, they've actually made it better for them to come back the next time. So cyclically, if they take hold, it just gets better and better and easier for them to come back the next time, which is why it's important to get on top of them.
Simon Tannick from New Algae Enviro. So, algae can be used to clean up waterways and to improve conditions for biodiversity and wildlife. And if you can grow more good non-toxic algae, then you can use it in all sorts of ways.
The future of algae biomass, as our company sees it, is going to be algae fibers, algae foams, both flexible and perhaps rigid, animal feedstock for beef cattle and perhaps other livestock, and who knows past that, it could be anything.
That's Rob Falcon, the managing director of a company called Bloom LLC. As Rob said, algae can be used as a food supplement for animals, or indeed for humans. Think of it in the same way that you think of seaweed as a food source. But Rob's company has been doing some amazing things with the material side of algae, harvesting it in the wild and then turning it into a natural powdered compound that they then use in the manufacture of different types of foams and plastics.
So the way that this works is that algae is not a filler. It's in a powdered state, which we produce both in Meridian, Mississippi and in Wuxi, China at our two factories. It is unlike a talcum powder or calcium carbonate powder that is used in various foam compositions just to, you know, add some low-cost savings. The algae itself is, in fact, a polymer. I mean, the polymers, by their definition, are a chain of amino acids, and you could literally make pure plastic from the algae powder. So the algae is an extremely valuable asset to this because it is adding value in ways that no one, to my knowledge, has seen before. For example, we have improvements to elongation of the foam, where a conventional EVA foam might have a certain amount of elongation. And when you add, let's say, 25% or 50% by load weight ratio of algae biomass powder into that resin matrix, we are seeing time and time again, elongation rate increases between 25 and 40% total. So that is to say, the elasticity of the foam is much higher now solely on account of the algae. We also are seeing, in most instances, double the tear strength of the foam. That is that the algae itself is adding significant improvement to the ability for the foam not to tear easily. We are seeing improvements to compression set, which is the rebound or the memory, the springiness of the foam. We are seeing resilience improvement, which in terms of running shoes means that the algae is imparting a value for how many miles run a pair of running shoes can go. An average pair of running shoes in the States, for example, can go about 350 or 400 miles run before the cellular foam collapses in a traditional polymer foam. We're seeing improvements in the early phases with our customers who are doing the testing, where there's an improvement to the life of the product. That is, that you can actually get more miles run with an algae foam versus a conventional EVA foam. So there's a multiplicity of ways that algae is improving the foam's properties solely from a performance standpoint.
Now, according to Rob Falcon, his company has harvested around 27,000 tons of algae so far. The beauty of algae, he says, is that it's abundant and natural. And by using algae in the process of manufacturing plastics and foams, well, that means less need for the use of petroleum products. And here's another interesting aspect of the work his company has been doing. They've also been hard at work developing a foam that has very high antimicrobial properties.
Hospital-acquired infections kill thousands of people per year. And obviously, anything that can inhibit a pathogen and inhibit its growth so successfully from a 100% pure plant-based material is quite something. And that's a natural material, non-genetically engineered, non-chemically modified. I mean, we're looking into this as potentially organic certifiable and something that can compete against silver and silver chloride, which is the ubiquitous material used in antimicrobial products to date. I should note, however, though, that we do not kill the pathogens. We inhibit their growth. And so I think there's a great potential for many fields of use. Any applications could be countertops. It could be in resins. It could be in concrete. It could be in fibers. It could be in plastics. It could be everywhere. I mean, you're talking about billions of dollars of industry globally that we have the potential to impact with positive change.
And you're listening to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. And today, we're looking at the potential of algae as a future positive environmental agent and as a useful product for manufacturing, for food, and for energy generation, among other things. Let's head to Germany now to meet Dr. Jan Vorm. Dr. Vorm is an associate director with the Global Consulting Engineers, ARUP. And ARUP have been testing what are called bioreactor panels on the outside of a building in Hamburg.
So we have a residential building, five-story building, and on the southwest and southeast facades, we have an external shading system, which is made of story-high panels, glass panels, in which also the water with nutrition is circulating, in which the algae are growing. So basically, it's very similar to a solar thermal panel, which is absorbing the daylight and the sunlight, and not just generating thermal energy, but also biomass through the cultivation of microalgae.
So from a street level, looking up at the building, the outside of the building is skinned in these big glass partitions, if you like, that glow a sort of green colour because of the algae. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we have about 130 panels on this four-storey building, and the skin of the panel is only interrupted by the windows of the building looking straight out. So the panels are not covering those windows, but they're covering the entire opaque surface area of the building. And it's correct. So if you see from the outside, it's a dynamic look of a bubbling panel. You don't really perceive the green color that much, but if you're on the other side, if you're on the balconies and looking through the panels against the light, it's a very vivid green color, which is structured by the rising air bubbles through the panel.
So the idea, just in case it's not entirely clear, is that these large glass panels filled with algae generate energy as the algae gives off heat during the process of photosynthesis. And then, in addition to that, the algae itself can be harvested from the panels in biomass form for use as an agricultural fertilizer or a food source, or even to make the sorts of products that Rob Falcon was telling us about earlier. Jan Vorm again.
So the building was opened in April 2013, and then we had a two-year monitoring program. And we looked at three things. So we looked at the technical performance, meaning all the technical components, whether they work and perform. We looked at the energy performance on the outcome of the system. And we also looked at the social acceptance through the users. And, of course, the latter one is crucial to gain acceptance of any sort of new technology. And this acceptance was tested through interviews, and the finding was that there is a lot of communication needed to explain what's actually happening and what the benefits are. And as long as you have that direct link to the habitants, the acceptance was really high. And also showed that whenever there was that link missing, the residents started to worry, not really understanding what's going on. So that's one thing. In terms of technical performance, you can see that truly the system has proved that it's technical performing, that it's feasible to integrate such a technology within a building. Of course, we had one or the other technical challenge to solve, which we did, but that's a very promising message. Then the energy performance is about half what we calculated it would be. So still we are net energy positive. We are making more than the system is consuming. And I think there is a high potential for getting back on track what we originally envisioned. So the biomass is about 4.5% of all light hitting, let's say, the facade is turned into biomass, and about 20% of all daylight is converted into heat. In both instances, we thought it would be about double, and as I mentioned, there were a little bit of a technical challenge here and there to solve, which impacted also on the overall performance. And we have just now fitted a new upgraded version, a new panel on the facades, which we are now starting to test in springtime, and we are looking forward to the results. So it has been a learning curve for us to see which parameters influence the performance, And yeah, we have been putting them back into a new design.
So you're pleased with the performance despite some of the teething problems, as you say, but is it worthwhile in terms of economics? Is it economically viable, given that I know the costs of the initial setup are quite expensive? You're talking somewhere around about $2,500 per square meter to install mm-hmm. these panels on the facade, aren't you?
Yeah, so the $2,500 is for the system and the facade, so for all the mechanical components needed, which is quite a number. Now, in terms of economical feasibility, it is crucial to set up a value chain around the algae which you harvest. So at the moment, on a good day, it's about 6 kilos a day that you harvest. And for the small amount of that number, there's not a commercial value chain set up at the moment. So we're using the outcome for research. But what we want to do and what's on track is to install a device which is not harvesting the algae to then transport them to a processor for food or for any sort of pharmaceutical products, but to extract the components that are valuable. So at the end, you end up with a liquid which contains the valuable ingredients, which you can easily transport and sell to the farm or the food industry. And then you have a technology in the value chain which you can scale up, especially in the regions of the world where algae is a basic product for food. Less so in Europe, I would say, but more in the sort of East Asia regions of the world.
Jan Vorm in Germany, from the engineering consultancy group Arup. Now, I want to pick up on that idea of using algae to build an energy-producing bioreactor, and also on the potential for such technology in the developing world in particular. Let me now introduce you to Professor Jonathan Trent. He's based at the NASA Ames Research Institute in California. Professor Trent is the director of a project called the Omega Global Initiative, the OGI. A few years back, he and his colleagues set out to investigate whether it was possible to build a self-sustaining power plant based on algae. And the OGI is the end result of that effort. Now, the prototype system they've developed is what's called a floating photobioreactor. In effect, it's a system that brings together solar panels and an algae-based wastewater sewage converter to produce energy, biomass, clean water, and the perfect environment for aquaculture, like fish farming. An all-in-one floating multi-purpose processing plant. Jonathan Trent.
The two major economic drivers turn out to be aquaculture on the one hand, depending on what you grow, which of course has to be locally compatible, and wastewater treatment on the other hand, which is an expensive thing that all of our major cities do. Those two things are the primary economic drivers. The algae can be an economic driver depending on where we are. The biofuels comes up as a sort of third place source of funding. And then the solar panels, most of the energy of which will go into helping us treat wastewater in the form of heating water and helping us process algae also from heat and some electricity. And then the electricity going into pumps that will move water around. But there still will be excess energy, electricity energy left over that can be sold onto the grid. Again, it depends where you are, and these things have to be adapted to the location. But the point is that it's a system of systems. It's an ecology of technologies. It's a way of envisioning how the waste products of one part of the system are feeding another part of the system. And by doing this in a closed loop, which we call at NASA closed loop life support systems, by doing this as a life support system, we can make it incredibly efficient. And the economics come along with that.
And it's easy to see, isn't it, for developing nations. You can imagine a reasonably poor community being able to use this kind of system not only to improve the environment around them, but also to, as you say, to generate money from it. It's, you know, cleaning up the environment wouldn't necessarily be a cost in the way that it currently is.
Absolutely. In fact, we've been talking to people in Tonga. The Fanga'uta Lagoon in Tonga is this perfect location. It's protected and highly polluted. And in Tonga, they need water. They would thrive on additional food production. And of course, the energy they now import for running generators to make their electricity, we could provide them with solar energy on from solar panels as well as biofuels. And it's a sustainable system. It is self-sustaining, using waste products as resources.
Can I get you to give us an idea of what these photobioreactors look like, and also just about scale? What sort of scale have you been working on so far, and how big do you see these things potentially going?
The infrastructure we're talking about could either be floating pontoons that you assemble, or they could be just like a marina. Imagine a sort of large-scale marina, depending upon the conditions and whether there's bad weather or how we would have to engineer this. If there's typhoons in the area, we might have to engineer it so we can rapidly dismantle it or sink it underwater. I mean, those are issues that need to come into consideration for the engineering, depending on the location. But it's not new technology. The aquaculture, people build aquaculture offshore all the time. And the algae utilized to treat wastewater is also really not new. People have been doing this for quite a time. You put wastewater into big ponds and the algae turn it into a biomass that settles out and that gets decomposed in the sediment of the pond. And so offshore solar panels, well, in Australia, you build offshore solar panels to cover reservoirs so you prevent evaporation. What the Omega Project is doing that's new is it's saying, well, look, let's bring all of these technologies together so that they work synergistically, so they are supporting one another. And we're doing this all offshore. We're moving this whole system offshore. So we bootstrap all the different components of it. And what we've done up to now is we've proved that we could grow the algae on wastewater. We studied how effectively we could remove the contaminants in the wastewater using the microalgae that we were growing. And we built a system of about 1,600 liters. So 450 gallons or so is the system that we built just to test it in large tanks at a wastewater treatment plant. But now the Omega Global Initiative is poised to build the first offshore system. And that's been the challenge, finding a place that not only has the right physical characteristics, which is not very challenging, there's lots and lots of those places in the world, but that has the right mindset, that wants to lead the world in this green revolution that we are really poised to start. And that's been a little bit more difficult, is finding the people who are willing to be first rather than the ones that want to be the first to be second. Most places want to see somebody else build it and then they'll copy it happily. But we are looking for the first installation.
So if you're a local government agency, a business, or even a community that wants to help lead the way, well, the door is open. Professor Jonathan Trent, and the project's name, once again, just in case you want to search for it online, is the Omega Global Initiative.
À Paris, quand un amour fleurit, ça fait pendant des semaines deux cœurs qui sourient, tout ça parce que qu'ils s'aiment à Paris. Au printemps.
Our final destination today on our algae-powered journey around the world is Paris. Yes, Paris, home to some very famous landmarks, the Eiffel Tower, the Arc de Triomphe, and the strategically placed green glowing algae carbon wells. Okay, the carbon wells are yet to catch on. In fact, they're yet to be built. Well, there is a prototype, but if the company Fermentalg have their way, there will soon be several of these wells dotted around the French capital. Think very large glass tubes filled with a bubbling solution of algae. Algae, like other plant forms, draw carbon from the air. So the idea, perhaps I should let Fermentalg's chief scientific officer, Hywel Griffiths, take it from here.
We are working with one of the larger water and treatment companies in France called Suez, and they have, with us, built a demonstrator that was actually part of the exhibition for the COP21 climate change conference in December of last year. And that is now working up in Paris. We're moving it around to look at its effectiveness in different sites and really putting together all the parameters that are required to make sure that this really is efficient and can then be rolled out to a larger scale.
And so what are we talking about with this demonstrator? I mean, what does it look like and how does it basically function?
Well, the idea very much is to make sure it fits into the landscape. And anyone who's been to Paris might remember that there are large columns dotted around the streets, mainly for people to post adverts on or information boards. So it's almost a large aquarium. It's 3 meters tall. And the algae grow in a liquid environment inside. And we provide the algae with artificial illumination. and we provide them with the wavelengths of light that they can use best for photosynthesis and therefore for bringing CO2 out of the air that we're bubbling through these columns and capturing it into cells.
And so these columns, because they light up, they're a light green colour, they'll be decorative, but their main role is to be positioned at various parts of the city and to try and soak up some of the carbon, some of the pollution that's there.
Exactly, yes. So the prettiness of them is entirely secondary to their function. The real aim of this is to improve the quality of the air in towns or cities around the world and to improve the quality of life of the inhabitants of the city.
Now, it sounds like a terrific idea. What are some of the problems, though, that are still to be overcome? What are some of the challenges that remain?
The main challenges really are integrating this into an urban environment. The part that I've not yet mentioned is, of course, that you're soaking up all this CO2 and you're producing algae. Each of these, when it's working at full tilt, will actually be producing a kilo or two of algae per day. And you've got to do something with that. And the advantage of working with Suez is that they have access to the infrastructure of the town already. So we will be putting the algae straight into the wastewater system. The wastewater system then takes it to a treatment plant. And in France and in Europe, certainly, a lot of wastewater treatment goes into a methanization process. So the biomass will be turned into biogas and then re-injected back into the city's natural gas network. So integrating that is of course, one of the challenges. Certainly algae provide a very good substrate for making biogas, these systems. But the challenge is very much making sure that this will work in an industrial-type manner so that we can really think about putting hundreds, if not thousands, of these around cities to make a serious impact on the quality of the air.
So you've got this demonstrator model, but this is, you're still really in the initial stages of testing out whether or not this can be scaled up, I suppose. Is that correct?
I would say that we are in the final stages of development in that we have a unit that is very similar to the one that will be rolled out around the cities, and we're using that to work out the final parameters. It's very much more than just an idea. It is something that works, and we have been running this column, this full-size column, for several months now, and it is producing biomass. So it's really working out whether the strains that we're using are adapted to all environments around Paris, whether we need to be looking at different strains for different purposes, because the strain is going to be different if we're, say, connecting these up to polluted air coming out of, industrial boilers or polluted air in road tunnels that sort of act as a concentrating mechanism for car exhausts. It may well be that different strains are more effective in those sorts of environments from the strains that we would perhaps use on the street. The aim is for each of these to be able to pull a ton of carbon dioxide out of the air per year, which doesn't sound like a lot, but there's actually about the same amount of carbon dioxide that 100 trees will pull out. So whilst, yes, it's probably just a small amount to clean the planet up as a whole, in these urban environments, it's actually doing very much more.
From France to the United States to Germany to Australia. Don't say we don't get around on this show. The wonder and potential of algae. And our guests were Hywel Griffiths, Jonathan Trent, Jan Vorm, Rob Falcon, and Simon Tannick. My co-producer here at Future Tense is Karin Savanovitz, the sound engineer Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
Il y a toujours des taxis en maraude qui vous chargent en fraude avant le stationnement. Oui, encore l'agent des taxis.